Great. Well, good morning, everybody. I hope that y'all are enjoying MVC Conf. My name is Brandon Satram, and I'm going to talk for the next hour about coding the right thing, specifically behavior-driven development in ASP.NET MVC using SpecFlow, Watton, and the MVC Contrib Watton test helpers. So let's go ahead and dive right in. I want to start by talking a little bit about queuing theory and how it helps us explain the rationale for TDD. This will all be very quick, and then I'll move into talking about test-first processes, and then finally some lengthy demos on using SpecFlow Watton and the MVC Contrib Watton test helpers. So a little bit about myself. My name is Brandon Satram. I am a developer evangelist with Microsoft. I'm based in Austin, Texas. I have over 11 years of experience in software and in technology, and I joined Microsoft about 7 months ago, and prior to that spent 2 years with a Microsoft Gold partner based in Colorado, and was the lead on about half a dozen different ASP.NET MVC applications. So as we get started, I do want to mention a little bit about religious debates, right? I recognize that the topic that I'm talking about today, test-first methods, can be quite contentious. And so I want you all to please consider this presentation a case study, not a collection of best practices. These are my practices, my opinions, not best practices. I may say some things that you disagree with in this presentation. I may even treat some terms slightly different than you do. And I know that we all have different opinions about this. But please don't think that I'm trying to tell you this is how your practice should be. I'm hoping to share some of my own understanding so people can walk away with a little bit more learning. And hopefully through the questions and through the feedback that I get from some of you all, that I can enhance and improve my understanding as well. So let's start by talking briefly about TDD and the theory behind the practice. Why would I do that? I find that I'm more willing to grow and evolve as a developer when I continue to question my current thinking and my opinions. My practices around TDD have evolved over the last several years, as I'm sure that many of yours have, because I've been willing to verbalize my intuition and ask if what I'm doing is the right thing or the best way. Beyond that, I want to talk about the theory behind TDD very quickly, because when I first picked up TDD, I found that it was difficult for me to really sell it to other developers, to managers, and executives in my organization. Even today, I think a lot of us have picked up TDD, but I wouldn't say that it's crossed the chasm. I think many folks still consider test-first methods to be a really fantastical discipline practiced by a bunch of kooks and contrarians who have trouble with authority. But as I've learned more about queuing theory, and as I've learned some of the theory behind TDD, I've found that its roots are logical and well-grounded. And I want to share some of those things with you all today. Hopefully, so like me, you can take some of that information back and improve your own practice and share that with others in your organization. So we start by asking about the goal of software development. I'm a big proponent of Eli Goldratt's writings around the theory of constraints. And Goldratt defines a constraint as anything that limits a system from achieving higher performance versus the goal. So we start any question like this about constraints by defining the goal. And Jim Copeland says that the objective or the goal of software is to deliver what the customer wanted while optimizing quality. The broader goal is to create value. So we want to create value for someone, deliver something that they want, something that they desired, while optimizing for quality. So if this is an accurate statement, then system constraints are anything that hamper our ability to create value and optimize for quality. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about what I learned about TDD and about system constraints while waiting in line. And let's look at a line at a basketball arena as an example. So a couple of years ago, I was at a San Antonio Spurs game with my wife, and I noticed something different than before. In years past, when I went to games, you would go through the ticket checker, hand them your ticket, they'd make sure that that was legit, scan your ticket, whatever, and then you'd have to wait in line while people who had bags had their bags checked for alcohol, food, fireworks, guns, any other kind of contraband that's not allowed inside of public sporting events. And if the bag checker found something that wasn't allowed to be in the arena, the person either had to go back to their car and return it, or trash it and move through the line. This ended up being a real bottleneck, right? For people that didn't have bags, you had to sort of wait in that process anyway. And for people that did, if you had to return to your car, you effectively went through the line twice. What was different about this particular time that I went is that the bag checker was out in front of the line, which ended up speeding the process, right? The bag checker was going through people's bags, only the people who had bags, and if you did have to go back to your car, you didn't have to go through the ticket checker twice, right? This sped up the flow for everyone, including the people that did have bags, and it kept people from going through the line twice. In the terms of the goal, the bag checker and their position in the line was a constraint. and that constraint was removed by moving the bag checker before the ticket checker. And the reason that moving that bag checker to the front of the line worked can be explained by queuing theory. And queuing theory, very simply put, is the study of lines in a system, arrival times, wait times, etc. If you've done any research into lean software development, queuing theory probably sounds pretty familiar. And while I'm not going to cover all of queuing theory today, I did want to talk about a subset of queuing theory that relates to the theory of constraints, and that is this statement. Given a process B, which follows process A, sometimes in performing B, we need to perform some of A again. So we can remove the need for rework by taking some portion of B and performing it before A. So regardless of what A and B are, you have two steps in a sequential system, and 20% of the time, the work done in A has to be sent back to A by B to be done again. So you can remove that rework by creating a cycle and doing at least some part of B before A. So what this means for software development is this. Assume that A is development and B is testing, our classic waterfall-ish cycle of writing the code and then verifying that it works, either by ourselves or by another external party. So suppose that when we test after development, 20% of the work is defective and has to be sent back to the front of the line. That's just a guesstimate. I've been on projects where it's been a whole lot higher than 20%, but assume that 20% has to be sent back. With queuing theory says that we can remove that rework or minimize that rework by moving at least some part of testing before development. So interestingly enough, this cycle, this process, looks very much like this, right? This is the classic red-green refactor test-driven development cycle. So the interesting thing to note here, and the reason why I bring all this up in the first couple of minutes of this presentation, is because TDD, for those of you that aren't yet practicing it, for the folks that may still be a little skeptical, does have a basis in theory and practice. This wasn't conceived as a way to make money or to be interesting. It's not witchcraft, and it's a process that's rooted in mathematical studies, systems theory, and even behavioral science. So when I picked up TDD, this was my process, right? The red-green refactor cycle of writing a failing test, making the test pass, and refactoring, that was my mantra and my SDLC. But I discovered, as many of you probably have, that it wasn't enough, right? This wasn't enough alone for me to truly improve my practice the way that I wanted to. I had really two particular problems with just adopting that process by itself in isolation that I discovered over time. The first was this process, this write a failing test, make the test pass, refactor process, doesn't really tell me what the first failing test is. I sort of have to pick at random based on what I think might be important or what I find to be the most interesting or the thing that I want to do at 8 o'clock in the morning on a given Monday. There's no real external direction. And the second thing is it's very easy for me to start speculating on features that I might not need when I'm in the groove. If my process is just to continue writing failing tests and make those tests pass, I might go down this rat hole of building out features and functionality that's not necessary. For example, I would traditionally start, let's say I'm using the repository pattern, and I'll start by building a customer repository that deals with customer entities in my database. I would start by building the save mechanism, the insert mechanism, the update mechanism, the retrieval mechanism, and then, because I want to be nice and complete and have my full CRUD, I would do the delete mechanism as well. The problem was that I wouldn't necessarily always know that that delete mechanism or even the update mechanism worked the way that it expected to work in the system. I was sort of speculating on all of the different positive and negative cases and edge cases and normal cases in the system. And I wasn't really alone in that experience. Dan North experienced some of the same issues in his practice, and there are definitely others. A lot of folks that I don't have time to cover today, but a lot of folks struggle with adopting TDD on a large scale over time and really maintaining the tests and making sure they're not brittle and things like that. But the reasons that I listed here and others really led Dan North to adjust his practice of TDD and then coin the term BDD to describe those differences in practice. And that difference can be really summarized in a shift in focus. And the statement that North made is working software that matters. His assertion is that test-driven development leads us to working software, but not necessarily to working software that matters. So consider the customer repository that I spoke about a few moments ago. If it's possible to delete a customer record because the repository supports it, but is never actually implemented in the UI nor desired by the customer, that's not working software that matters. It's working software, but it's ultimately waste in the system. So the two things that are different in terms of shifting focus, and the first is to focus on actual behaviors, right? To what the software really needs to do to meet the goal. And again, the goal is to deliver value and optimize for quality. So rather than getting bogged down and specifying an API, as I tended to do in TDD, just sort of building out this public class with a series of methods and figuring, regardless of how it was being used, that I was doing the right thing, I think about how the software is to be used by the human, moving from an API to actual behaviors. That gives me the benefit of staying focused. As well as if you see a lot of BDD-style unit tests, you'll likely notice a couple of different things. The first is that the test context tends to be finer-grained. Maybe not even one test class per object, but maybe a test per context of the repository, if that's the example that we're talking about here. I may have one test class for just saving, for inserting and updating, and one for retrieval. There's also, you'll see, an emphasis on the use of the word should in test method names. And some folks, I think, tend to minimize this. I've heard people say that the only difference between TDD and BDD is using the word should in your test method name. And that's not true. That's an oversimplification of the process. But even if it were, North argues, and I agree, that should is a psychological term. It allows the software to be questioned. When you're writing a test and you think about using the word should, you should be thinking about, should I actually do this? Is this functionality that the user will receive value from or have benefit? So some take that BDD process and implement that new context and think more about the behavior inside of their unit tests. And that's a great evolution in practice, but it's still, to me, and it answers the question of sort of how to keep things under control in terms of not allowing, not speculating on design and thinking about actual uses. But what it doesn't really do, for me at least, is answer the question of which test to write first, right? Where to begin. BDD at the unit level also doesn't address another kind of rework that we're going to talk in a moment, and that's talk about now. And that's rework that happens at a different point in our process, and that is user acceptance testing, or when the user actually gets the software in their hands. And so what you'll see, what I've seen a lot of times in my practice, and again, this might just be me, but is that I'll go through my wonderful dev test cycle. I'll have a great suite of unit tests, and I'll hand some production code over. And then the customer will look at that and say, yeah, this is nice, and I know that this is well tested and everything, but this isn't exactly what I was looking for. So I still experience a bit of rework as I move to the next part of that process. I've got a great TDD process, but now when I get into UAT, acceptance testing, verification, whatever you want to call it, in theory, maybe let's say 20% of the time, I see rework in that. And again, going back to queuing theory states that I can eliminate that rework by moving at least some part of C, in this case, user acceptance testing, to the front of the line. So I can perform some level of acceptance testing prior to the test-driven development cycle. All right, that's nice, that's fine and good in theory, but what does it actually look like in reality? And this is a graphic from a great book that I highly recommend called Growing Object-Oriented Software Guided by Tests by Steve Freeman and Nat Price. According to Freeman and Price, the first step in the process is to really write a failing end-to-end test, right? That's your acceptance test. That specifies what the user expects to get in the system, and then that is used to move forward. What I love about this process is that it really illustrates where acceptance test-driven development, or ATDD, which is really a subset of BDD, where that fits into a test-driven development cycle. Because you really have two loops here. You have the outer loop of the acceptance test, which drives an overall feature. And then you have a series of unit tests that are designed to build out each individual portion or step within that feature. And it answers the question of what the first unit test is, because it's the first step in your end-to-end test or in a scenario in your feature. Another great thing is that this process is designed to make user acceptance criteria an automated part of the verification process. Okay, so end-to-end test, acceptance test, what does that actually look like? You start with a feature, with a story, right? With the backlog you already have, if you have stories that describe the user and their context and their objective, that's great. You use that to start. And then taking that story, taking that feature, you write a series of scenarios that I'll show you in a moment that define the steps that the user takes to actually perform that work in the system and how you know that it's actually done. So you go and implement one step at a time, and then the story is done when the value is implemented as described. What's interesting about this process is that we have tools now that enable us to truly treat an acceptance test as an executable asset. You'll see this referred to a lot as executable specifications, and they are truly that. These are specifications written in the language of the business that can be executed by a testing tool. And this leads, for me at least, to a huge shift in perspective, right? The story itself is the first test, and the application itself is the entry point for testing, not a public method in a class file. So I'm going to talk today about the tools that I use for that kind of testing. For the feature creation part of that, I use SpecFlow. There are other tools that are available inside of .NET. A lot of these things were sort of inspired by Cucumber, but in .NET there's also Cuke for Nuke, which is a similar tool. They're both inspired by Cucumber and use some of the same underlying vocabulary and the parser to parse the feature files. But I write my feature files in SpecFlow, and then SpecFlow will take those and, using my test runner, MS test, in unit, what have you, and will match those to step definitions, actual code that I'll then use to drive the browser through Watton. So I use Watton and the MVC contrib Watton test helpers to help me drive that browser directly. Again, SpecFlow doesn't mandate this, right? You can use SpecFlow and test directly against your controllers, and I'll often still do that for some unit level tests or for some more fine-grained integration tests. But in the case of end-to-end tests, I want to get as close to mirroring the actions and the behaviors of the user as possible. So within this outer inner loop context, on the left-hand side, in writing a failing end-to-end test, that's where I'm using SpecFlow and Watton. And on the right-hand side, I jump into my test-driven development cycle. And that's what I'm going to demonstrate and talk about today, is how SpecFlow works and fits in with that broader process. So let's jump into that. And I'm going to talk a little bit about this application, this fictional application that I'm working on called RazorLib. Now, RazorLib is a very similar to RegexLib. It is a sharing site for Razor helpers and snippets and things like that. It allows people to post information and comment and things like that, what you would expect if you went to a site like RegexLib for code sharing. So I have a series of projects here. I have my MVC3 site, I have infrastructure and core, and I have my unit tests and acceptance tests. The first thing that I did is I went to specflow.org to download and install SpecFlow, because there's some integrated Visual Studio tooling that I want, some syntax highlighting in my features and things like that. But I put all of those in my acceptance test project, and then the references that I use in my application are techtalk.specflow and mvccontrib.watton, and both of these are available currently as NuGet packages. You can get Watton if you want to use it separately at watton.sourceforge.net, but if you use the MVC contrib Watton test helpers, the watton.core assembly and a couple of its dependencies are IL merged into this main assembly, so that you just have one assembly along for the ride. So you can install that with NuGet and then get everything you need to get moving. So the first thing that you'll notice in here is this register.feature file, and you notice that that extension is recognized by Visual Studio through the SpecFlow tooling extension. It's got this nice little, this cute little cucumber logo here. And so this is a feature file. All right, so I have my story defined. You notice that I've got syntax highlighting here. I'm specifying the goal, the user's goal, their context, and the work that they're attempting to perform. And then I create one or more scenarios. I'm just going to have one scenario in the files that I use today, but typically I could have many, many more scenarios in a single file. And in the scenario, I'm using what's called given when then, or GWT syntax, to describe the steps in the test. I mentioned already that Cucumber and SpecFlow and Cuke for Nuke and Cuke for Duke all use some of the same underlying parser for parsing these files, and that's called Gherkin. The idea here is that each of those tools expect the same sort of format when you're authoring a test. It's still human readable, still plain English, but you need to use a given to start, given when and or then to start each individual line. And in the given, I'm using that to set up the context, where I am to start the test. And then I have a series of steps that I perform for my when. And these are the things, this is the actual test, this is the steps that the user would take in the system. And then my then is my verification. And with each individual step here, I can use and with givens, with whens, and with thens to perform multiple verifications or multiple execution steps or multiple setup steps and things like that. So SpecFlow recognizes this, but it goes beyond that, right? Because this, at some point, something has to step in and turn this to actual executing code that runs my system. So if you click on properties of one of the feature files, you'll notice that there's a custom tool that's being used for this feature file, and it's the SpecFlow single file generator. What that does is that actually takes your feature file and parses that into a test class that uses your test runner. So you'll see with each feature file this code behind .feature.cs or .vb file that actually uses your the attributes for your test, for your actual test framework. In this case, I'm using MS test, and specifies the actual class, performs some feature setup and teardown kind of work, some scenario setup and teardown work, and then when you get to your test itself, And again, this is auto-generated code, so you never want to change this yourself, because every time you save the feature file, the SpecFlow single file generator regenerates this information. But just so you can see kind of what's going on behind the scenes, SpecFlow will create a scenario info object that has information about your test in the title. Do some setup, and then the test runner then performs each of your steps. It passes in a given, a when, an and, or a then. It passes the test name in as a string, and I'll show you what that, and what that's doing is the test runner is using that string to match to an actual step definition somewhere that SpecFlow, in a class that SpecFlow has access to determine the code that needs to be executed. So I perform each one of these steps. SpecFlow can also take this information in this pipe delimited set of fields here and turn that into a table. Each row is a dictionary with field and values. And then pass that into the test runner, perform the verification, collect any errors, and report that back to you. So from here, let's go ahead and run this in a moment. Take a look at any. Let me take a look at some questions we have while this is running. Okay, I see Eric, I'm seeing a 4 up here, but I'm not actually seeing any. Oh, there it is. Okay. Okay, so the question is, the feature says I want to be able to register for a new account, and then says, then I will see a logout link. Assume I've already written all the data access and persistence. That's not true. Actually, this test needs to be the first thing that I write before I've written data access and persistence and things like that, right? At least that's the way that I prefer to do it. I don't want to start with, that was my problem with TDD, is the thing that was most interesting to me was writing all of the repository stuff and persistence and messing with that first. So I sort of did this inside-out approach to building my application. What I want to do here instead is an outside-in approach. I want to take and define my feature first and then iterate across my unit tests as I move into the application. So I'm going to show you, I'll show you that in a moment. So you'll see, I see an inconclusive, so no step. So you'll see this when you don't have those steps defined properly, and that is no matching step definition found for one or more steps. And if you go into the result here, you'll see that SpecFlow does very similar to what Cuke for Nuke or Cuke for Duke or Cucumber will do. And if it can't find matching step definitions, it'll auto-generate the code for you. It'll show you what you need to create inside of a class file. So you need a class file with this binding attribute. That's part of the techtalk.specflow assembly. That's how SpecFlow knows to look for actual steps inside there. And then you need attributes on each public method to specify a given, a when, or a then inside the actual test itself. And so it'll show me this for every single one of my steps in here as it matches those things. And then what I can do is I can take all this information here and copy it into class files before I run that. I don't need to do that here because I'm just going to go ahead and comment these things out. I have a series of classes already that I can use here. This I have a scenario helper that's doing some setup and teardown work for me inside of SpecFlow. But really what we want to look at is a couple of these here. So you'll see I have three different classes here that do different work inside of this feature. A reference to the SpecFlow assembly, and I am putting a binding on this public class to show SpecFlow, to tell SpecFlow, look here for step definitions, for code that you can use to execute those features. And the way that it matches that is by this attribute that passes in the same string that I have on my feature, given I'm on the site homepage. So I'm going to copy that. I'm going to comment this one out too, as well as this one. And I'll walk through each of these very quickly. So when given I'm on the site homepage, really all I'm doing is navigating to the homepage. I'm using the static type that I have in a helper called webbrowser.driver. I'll show you this here. That's actually where I'm using. I do two things in here. I have a current property, which uses the, which provides an instance of the current instance of the IE type, and that's part of Watton. You're actually treating the browser as an object and driving it that way. And then what I'm doing is I'm actually storing an IE object inside of what's called scenario-context.current, and this is something that SpecFlow uses to preserve state from one step to another inside of a scenario. So I can use scenario-context.current and put objects inside of this dictionary and then use those and retrieve those so that when I'm running a step, I have a step that navigates to the home page and a second step that wants to click on a link there. I need to make sure that I have the same browser and the same state and I'm on the same page for each one of those scenarios. And so SpecFlow enables me to do that by storing those shared things inside of this scenario context. So the driver here is an instance of the MVC Contrib Test Helper Watton driver. And that's a great simple class that allows me, that gives me some helpers and some easy methods to actually work with Watton to do some simple things like entering form field data and things like that. This is a small assembly. There's not a ton to it, but I find it immensely useful and I would highly recommend using it. So I'm taking that, I'm getting a new instance of the driver with my current instance of IE using my base URL, and then I'm either setting that or I'm passing it back if I already have it. So, and then I'm calling the driver and navigating to the home page. You can see some of the other things that are available in Watton Test Helpers. I have setting and getting text values, navigating to pages, getting row counts, executing scripts, clicking buttons, links, and row links. And then what I find the most useful feature, capturing screenshots and screen capture on failure. I would, for that reason alone, I would recommend using the Watton Test Helpers, especially in a situation like this. If I'm using SpecFlow and Watton to automate my test runs and I'm running those in an unattended fashion, I can put at the end of each scenario this driver.capture screenshot and actually get a screenshot of the current state as an audit trail so I can go back in and check and make sure, see why something failed or see if it actually passed for the right reason and things like that. So I've got all these. I'm going to go ahead and rerun this now. Run that again. You see it's a Watton clicking login, clicking register, and we're moving on from there. So it's going to do that quickly. Sometimes that'll come in and out before you can see it. Nice. Go ahead and run that one more time. Okay, let's just go ahead and move on. I'll show you what it looks like through here. Click on the register link, enter username, password, confirm password, it signs you into the site. It's very simple. I don't know why it's being squirrely for me right now. So let's go back. So we have a working feature from here, and I can close these out, and that's nice, but we need to add some new functionality, right? Just registering for the site isn't going to do much for us. We need to do more. So I'm going to go into add new item, and I'm going to add a new feature. And when you install SpecFlow, you get these three templates, one for event and step definition. Those are both code templates, and then one for a feature file. So I'm going to create a new feature file here, and I'm going to call it create helper.feature. Click add, and then it gives you some default text. I'm going to copy my text in here. So this is a feature to create Razor helpers. So this is my goal, who I am, and the work that I want to be able to accomplish. And then my individual scenario. So create a new helper using the Solution Explorer. Right-click, add new item, and that SpecFlow, when you install it, gives you three different templates, one for the feature file, which we're using now, and then a couple of different code templates that we're going to look at in a moment. So I'm creating a new helper. That's the scenario I want to work on now. So I establish some context. Given I'm logged into the site and I'm on the site homepage, I'm going to click on a few links, enter some form information, and then I have some verification to make sure that that's been created on the screen. So I'm going to go ahead and run this now. And I know that it is not going to pass. Okay, now it's missing a step definition, right? So the binding is actually looking for this context, that given I am logged into the RazorLib website doesn't actually exist yet. So that's functionality, that's a step definition that I need to create. So I'm going to come here into Solution Explorer again. I've got a steps folder, and one thing I'll mention is a nice thing with SpecFlow is that it's just looking for a class with a binding attribute. You can organize your actual step definitions any way you like, and definitely organizing them for reuse is my recommendation, and I'll show you what I mean by that in a moment. So, and create helper. And so part of the reason that I want to use these, here, let me copy that in. Actually, never mind. I just created the wrong one. I'm a little early. Do add new item. And this is going to be login.cs, right? Because I just need to specify the information needed for logging into the site. Take this, copy it. All I'm doing here is I'm using the Watton driver, Watton Test Helpers, to navigate to account logon, enter username and password to log in. Again, this is just a simple test site. I want to click the logon button and then make sure that I've been redirected to the home page and that the logout text actually exists on the screen. So once I've created that, I can go ahead and run this again, and it'll move me a little bit further on down the line. And I know with the refresh rate that some of y'all are experiencing, some of this stuff might come up and go away very quickly. So I'm going to not rely entirely on Watton to show everything slow enough. I'll show you what just happened. I logged into the site and then clicked on the helpers link on the homepage, right? And what that did is that it can't find that page, right? The helpers controller doesn't exist. The action itself doesn't exist. So now what I'm doing is SpecFlow is leading me. I know I don't have that functionality implemented. So I'm being led from my outer loop into an inner test-driven development loop. So I know that I need a helpers controller. But in order to really prove the need for that controller, I need to create a test that expresses that first. So I'm going to do add new test. I'm going to click helpers, controller, tests. And then I'm going to define the test for the actual, for the index method, right? That's not even going to build yet, so of course I need to create my controller at this point. I'm going to do add new controller, and I'm going to call that helpers controller. And then I'm going to take this default, I'm going to copy something else in. I just want to return null because I want to make sure that this test fails for the right reason. The worst thing that I could have happen at this point is for the test to pass for the wrong reason. So now I'm going to come in and run that. Delete some of these other tests here. Right, so that failed for the right reason now, right? What I'm doing in the test is just asserting that the result is not null and that the view name that gets passed back is the list view. So I know that I need that. I can come back into my actual index action and implement that at this point. Very simple. One thing I will mention is that in the interest of time that I have actually already created all of these views, you wouldn't do that. I want to emphasize because this is an outside-in process. None of this stuff would exist ahead of time. I'm just saving those now so that that saves us from that step in the process. We're just kind of quickly going through the inside-out loop here. The outside-in loop. So I'll run that test, and that's now going to pass. So when that passes, I know that I've gotten closer, so I want to run my acceptance test again. While that's running in the background through Watton, let me just show you in a little bit more slow motion what's happening. And it's going to do the same action. It's going to go to the home page, then it's going to click on the helpers link. It's going to come here, then it's going to click on the create a helper link, and boom, fail again because I don't actually have the create action on the helpers controller. So at this point, I know that I need to create that. So in order to do so, of course, I need to specify the need for that first inside of a test. So I'm going to create a test. Newing up the controller, I want to call the create action, determine the results not null, make sure I get the right view name, and then get an instance of the model and make sure that the type on that is of type helper. So there's two things that I need to do here to get this to build. The first thing that I need to do is go into my actual controller and create this controller method. Again, I'm just returning null so that it fails for the right reason. And then I need to create an instance of the actual helper type that I want in my model. So I'm going to come in and I'm going to create a new class, just helper.cs, and all I want to do is get this thing to compile so that it will fail. So I'm not going to bother implementing this at this point. I'm just going to get it to the point where the thing will build so that I can get it to fail, and I know that it's going to fail for the right reason. So create an instance to that, add this test to my test run, that's going to fail, so I can go ahead and finish the create method at this point. And I'm just going to do that by returning a new instance of helper and then passing in the create view. Come back and run this again. It will pass, so I can move back up to my acceptance testing, my acceptance test here, and I'll show you what's happening here, running this in slow motion. Now when I navigate to the create page, it blows up again. Now, so I've created helper.cs. I was able to get the test to pass, the unit test to pass, but the acceptance test didn't pass because I don't actually have that. I don't actually have helper.cs defined. Right now it's just empty. So I need to go in to helper.cs and actually finish defining this appropriately. So to find that, build it, I'll run my acceptance test again. And at this point, the page will come up just fine. The page is going to come up just fine, and so Watton will be able to, at this point, do a little bit more work, right? It's going to be able to actually attempt to enter these fields, and it'll click on the Create Helper link, but nothing's going to happen because I haven't yet created an action that accepts a post. But before I get to that problem, I am still missing a step definition for the verification step in here, right? The final step inside of my feature is this step, that I should see the message Helper created on the screen. That's my verification to make sure everything works. And it doesn't see that yet. SpecFlow doesn't see that because I haven't yet defined a step definition for that. So I'm going to come into my acceptance test project, and I'm going to click on Add New Item, and I'm going to create a new step definition file, and I'm going to call that createhelper.cs. And when you create these, SpecFlow is nice, it gives you some sample test code. So you can kind of see what's going on there. But this is a very simple step. I'm just asserting that the text helper created exists on the screen. There's not much to that. When I run this again, it's going to fail. I'm going to skip that at this point because, again, I know that I need the post method. So at this point, I can go in and add that. I'm going to create the test for it first. And what I'm doing here is I'm creating a new instance of the helper type with dummy data, newing up the controller, calling the create method, passing in the instance of that helper, the create action, passing in the instance of that helper, making sure the ID is greater than 0, etc., etc. I need to actually create that method inside of my controller. In order for this to build, I will do so and then go ahead and add this to my test run. Okay, so that failed for the right reason. I can come back into the create method and go ahead and complete that. Of course, I'm not completing it at this point. All I'm doing is calling the redirect action. I'm still not doing anything to actually save the helper. So I know I need to do that at this point. And my decision point here is I'm moving into another sort of TDD cycle with another object because now I need to create data access. I need to worry about my repository and how things are getting saved. But in order to justify the need for that, I need to first actually create a test to specify that. So I'm going to go into repositories and click Add New Test. And I'm going to click in helper, type in helper repositories test. Copy that in. Right, so here's the actual type that I'm passing in. I'm creating a new instance of the helper repository and calling the save method. Obviously, again, this does not exist yet, so I can go in and create that now. I'm going to create that repository and infrastructure. Very simple. Just call it helper repository, and then I'm going to implement the save method. All right, I'm implementing it as null at this point, again, because I want the helper repository test to fail for the wrong reason. I'm going to add that to my test run, and so you can sort of see that I'm three levels deep now. I've got my acceptance test, my unit controller test, and now I'm in my repositories test. I'm moving sort of down the chain of implementing this functionality. So now I can implement save. I've got that. Oh. And my wonderful data access strategy here is a static list. Highly recommended for its infinite scalability. And I'm doing a random number generator for the ID, right? So I've generated that. I've added that code. This should pass at this point. And once that does, I can add the repository to my controller. Now, I don't want to new up the repository here, right? I'm using an IOC container. I want to go ahead and have that injected into the controller. So I'm going to add a little bit of code here that enables me to do that. Now, I don't have an iHelper repository yet. I haven't created an interface because I haven't had a need for it until now. But I do have a need for it now, so I'm just going to go ahead and extract that interface. I'm going to place it in another file. And then, because I'm picky like that, I'm going to take that file, put it in my core assembly, update the reference, make sure the namespace declarations are correct. Save this. So now inside of the controller, I should be able, I'll be able to call this, and then I can also call this inside of my create method. call save and save that. Now, before I run this inside of my controller test, one of the things that I need to do is I need to come back in here because now there's no parameterless constructor. I need to pass in a reference to the helper repository. Now, what I would probably do at this point is I would refactor these three calls out into a factory method of some kind that would handle the work of providing that for me, since it's all the same. That way I could change my strategy for that later. But for the sake of brevity, I'm just going to go ahead and do that. And now at this point, I can run this test again, and this will pass. And once that passes, now I step all the way back up the chain, back into my acceptance test. Now, what's going to happen at this point when it runs is it's going to come back correctly and save it, but you'll notice there is no, I'm going to get an error when I do that, because there is no details method. Nope. Okay, so I'm back inside. My acceptance test has failed, and so I know that I need to do, I know what I need to do at this point because it's inside of my controller, right? I'm redirecting to the details action, and that action has not yet been created, of course. In order to create that action, the first thing that I need to do is create the test for it, right? So I create a new instance of the helper, a new instance of the controller, call the create method, make sure the ID is greater than zero, and then call the details action, which doesn't yet exist. So I'm going to go back into my helper's controller, and I'm going to add that. Now here, instead of doing null, I skipped that step really quick to show I'm just calling get inside of my repository, and of course that doesn't exist yet, so I need to create a test for that inside of my repository test, right? I haven't yet implemented the functionality to actually retrieve something out of the helper's repository. So I create the test for that, very similar, calls the save, and then tries and goes and get that back out. So I'm going to add that to my to my interface first, and then once I've added that to my interface, I'm going to add that method to my actual repository. Of course, I'm going to do it null, and then go back into my repository test. This will build, and I can go ahead and add it to my test run. And it's going to fail because it's null, so I can come back into the repository and implement that at this point. It failed for the right reason. This is simple, just a simple singular default based on the ID. I can come back into my test run. I'm running my repository test, right, my bottom level step. Once that passes, I'm going to step back up into my controller and I'll run that controller test. And then once that passes, I can come in and run the full acceptance test. I'll try to catch IE. I'll try to catch Watton quickly so that you can see what's happening here. And then I'll show it to you in slow motion, of course. I'll show it to you in slow motion anyway. So running the full test at this point, I click on the helpers link. I click create a helper. This Watton obviously will be doing this for me automatically. Enter some dummy data. Click create helper. I verify that functionality has been created. And my test finishes successfully. Let's see if it actually did in the background. No, of course it did not. but what you see here is that I've been able to use SpecFlow, Watton, and the Watton test helpers to really create an end-to-end set of functionality. It really allowed me to put some virtual blinders on so that I only worked on that functionality that was really pertinent to the feature that I was attempting to implement. And I stepped outside from my acceptance test into my unit test, into my controller test, and finally into the repository tests. I want to have a mention naming a little bit. I know I've used terms like TDD, BDD, and ATDD today. And I may not use them the way that you do, and I think that's okay. The thing that really matters is the process and its ability to help you meet the goal, right? That's the thing that really matters in the context of using these technologies and using any sort of a test-first method. And remember that the key, the bottom line, is that to remember the goal. And the goal of any test-first process is to minimize rework, right? Some percentage of that minimization is always going to be unique to you, to your company, and et cetera. So if you want to pick up these tools, do so because you think that it's going to be something that actually enhances your practice and enhances your ability to meet the goal. Don't pick them up because they're cool, and don't keep using them because they're cool if they don't work for you. I mean, that's one thing that I would highly recommend is if you take nothing else from this presentation, take away the knowledge that any improvement in our practice starts with a question about the status quo. My own practice improved and hopefully will continue to improve because I was willing to question my thinking. And as Eli Goldratt would say, to never allow inertia to become a constraint for myself. So I encourage you to definitely do the same. I'm going to pick up the questions in just a moment. I did want to mention some resources. Specflow.org to actually install Specflow, Watton.sourceforge.net. To get Watton by itself, and to if you want to get through the MVC Contrib test helpers, go to mvccontrib.codeplex.com. The slides and demos for today are at bit.ly/BDD, Specflow, capital S, capital F. And, of course, I know that all of these, this presentation and all the others from today will be available online. The book that I mentioned earlier, Growing Object-Oriented Software Guided by Tests, that's at amzn.to/attddbook. Great article by J.B. Rainsberger on TDD that I'd recommend. And then also, some of the tools that I mentioned today, I know that I blitzed through a lot of this stuff, and so I would encourage you to go to bit.ly/MVC screencasts, all lowercase. I'm doing a series of screencasts on using open source with MVC. Started that in November, and we'll be doing that through May. And two of those were on Specflow and Watton that I released last year. And then the next one that's coming up next Monday is actually on the MVC Contrib Watton test helper. So I highly recommend taking a look at that. And then also for more information on this presentation, I wrote an article at the end of last year for the December 2010 issue of MSDN Magazine, and I would encourage you to check that out. Any feedback that I don't get to today, feel free to grab me via email or on Twitter. Let me know what you think. Also, you can find me at my blog. Go ahead and minimize this so that I can actually see the Q&A section here. And I'm going to go ahead and answer some of the questions now. So are we going to get source files for this presentation? Yeah, if you go to, go back a couple of slides here, you can get the source files here. They're already up there, including a longer version of this presentation that I've done before at bit.ly/BDD Specflow. So feel free to go and grab those anytime. They're up there as of this moment. So go ahead and remove that. Do you think Watton will be useful to automate complex UI scenarios? I think that's a fantastic question. I can't claim that I've actually pushed its limits, because when things do tend to get pretty complex, very jQuery driven and things like that, it's definitely still possible, and I would encourage looking at it at least in some form. But I don't know that I would be comfortable saying that ultra complex scenarios would be good for Watton. That said, I would actually encourage you to use it and try that out, and if it doesn't work, to push on the tool, right? I mean, Watton is good, but it needs to continue to be supported and enhanced and improved. And so if you find its limits, post on the discussions, definitely raise those so that the tool can continue to be improved. Does Watton work with things like jQuery menu? It does. And the Watton test helpers give you some easier use in that by executing and evaluating scripts. And so you do have access to JavaScript inside of Watton. To the top here, are you using the built-in VS 2010 test runner, or is that part of the Specflow or Watton tooling? So my test runner, I should have mentioned this. The test runner that I was using today was actually part of ReSharper. So I am using MS Test for my test, but I like to use ReSharper regardless of if I'm using MS Test or InUnit. That's my actual test runner. If there are no repository tests or unit tests before writing the Specflow test, then you'll be moving back and forth to write repository tests and unit tests, and this will lose your main focus on the Specflow test to which you initially started. I have to say that I disagree. I don't think it loses focus. It may lose focus in terms of just being in the repository or just being at the acceptance test level, but in a lot of ways it's blinders. It enhances your focus because you're only working on the aspects of the system that are relevant to building out that feature and that functionality. I've found as I've spent more time dealing with and working inside of these tools, that I become more productive and move faster, even though I'm not necessarily staying in the same code file or same small set of code files all the time. So I'd have to say that I do disagree with that statement. Let's see. We have a complex case where there are jQuery tabs rendering partial views. Once I move between the tabs, the IDs are repeated, and Watton is finding the invisible control from the first tab with the same ID, where I'm expecting to find the control on tab 3. Is there a recommended way to handle this? Ah, you know, that's a great question, and that would probably be one that would be good to take offline. So if you want to email me or ping me on Twitter at Brandon Satram, I'm going to take that one out of here because that may be, I probably need a little bit more information to be able to help you with that one. At what point would you refactor the repository to use generics? Ah, that's a great question. Probably the second I start using a second repository. Right? I mean, I would refactor when there's a need for it, and just having one repository, there's not yet a need at that point. So, but I would definitely move in and refactor at that point. With Watton, how easy supported is driving Firefox and or Chrome instead of IE? At this time, Firefox is supported with Watton, and Chrome is not, as far as I know. It may be in one of the alpha or beta builds, but it's not at this point. But Firefox is supported out of the box. All right, let me go back to that one in just a second. Sorry, this is off topic, but what do you use for code coverage? Unfortunately, I've never really settled on a good, like, this is the tool that I use for code coverage. I really like NCover, and NCover comes with testdriven.net, a free version of it does, so I would recommend using that. I can't say that I've ever used any of the paid tools, though, so if anybody has and you want to chime in, please do. Does Watton work with Chrome? Like I said, I'm not sure it does at this point. Oh, okay, here's the answer. You know what, and I thought I had fixed that, but definitely with Bitbucket, you need to put a slash on the end, so when Bitly turns this BDD spec flow, and I thought I'd fix that, into the actual URL, which is here below, bitbucket.org/bsatram/presentations, yada yada, put a trailing slash on the end of that. Thank you for that, Nelson. I appreciate the help there. Yeah, so did you say BDD/BDD spec flow? When you do that, again, when you do that and Bitly turns it into the real URL, just add a slash on the end and you should be okay. And if you still have problems, just ping me on Twitter. And yeah, Bitly is case sensitive, which is fantastic. Do you see value in creating multiple projects up front, like entities, core, data access services, et cetera, I do, because typically in the teams that I've worked on, we've had a practice, especially in MVC apps, we've had a practice that we've used to organize our solutions. And so if you know that that's going to be the practice that you follow, I don't see much harm in going ahead and starting with that from the beginning. I did some of that stuff just to save time. I mean, I didn't have anything in core when I first started this demo. I may not necessarily need to do that, but if I'm going to do that and just want to create those as empty, there's nothing wrong with doing that. And if you're using some sort of tool like Solution Factory to actually generate some of that stuff for you, then obviously you would just have some of that stuff up front. I get the Yagni argument, definitely, but in the cases where with projects, I know that I'm going to need core and know that I'm going to need infrastructure, so I'm going to go ahead and start those. Is Selenium available as an alternative? Very much so. So I choose to use Watton in this case. You could very much use Selenium and drive that using SpecFlow the same way. There is no coupling between SpecFlow and Watton at all. So you're free to use whatever browser driver that you want. Let's see. Robert Fall. Hold on, let me get that right question. What sort of integration does SpecFlow? Remove that one. Could you use SpecFlow with TFS Team Build? That is a great question. I have used Qt for Nuke with Team Build before, but I haven't yet gone down the road of trying to use SpecFlow with it. I don't see any reason why you couldn't. In fact, there's probably no reason why you couldn't use SpecFlow by itself. The only thing that you'll ever run into an issue with is sometimes when you use Watton, you have to run Watton, especially if you kind of try to run it through. You have to run it kind of through an interactive console window if you're running it in an automated fashion. So when I've used it in the past with like Team City, I've had some issues with the Watton piece of that, but not with SpecFlow. So I would definitely check with that with Team Build as well. Have you tried Selenium? And if so, in what ways is it a better choice? I haven't used Selenium in a while, and to be honest with you, I need to, because to your point, Ryan, Watton hasn't been updated in over a year. So that one's bad on me. I'm going to go ahead and do that and maybe try to repurpose some of that with Watton and see if I can kind of do a compare and contrast. So that's a good point. Okay. How useful is SpecFlow Watton for already available automated web application integration testing? I think that's another great scenario where you could use it. Even if you don't have all of those things defined, you're not moving into the unit level cycle, but you could very much jump and create all of your acceptance tests and then run those against your existing functionality as sort of a way to shore up what you have already. So I'm going to need to stop there because we are out of time and Eric's about to wring my neck. So I'm going to go ahead and stop there. Any feedback on Twitter, I would love to hear, and feel free to email me anytime too. Thank you.